The Kyoto Accords, now treated as sacred because of President Bush's cavalier rejection of them, is in fact a treaty marked by its adherence to the old worldview. Kyoto assumed that if the West came together and settled on a plan, the Third World would adopt the new framework and the problem would be solved. That may have been the way things have been done in international affairs for decades, but it makes little sense today. China, India, Brazil, and other emerging powers will not follow along with a Western-led process in which they have not participated. What's more, governments on their own can do only so much to tackle a problem like climate change. A real solution requires creating a much broader coalition that includes the private sector, non-governmental groups, cities and localities, and the media. In a globalized, democratized, and decentralized world, we need to get individuals to alter their behavior. Taxes, tariffs, and wars are the old ways to do this, but states now have less room to maneuver on these fronts. They need more subtle and sophisticated ways to effect change. The traditional mechanisms of international cooperation are relics of another era. The United Nations system represents an outdated configuration of power. The permanent members of the UN Security Council are the victors of a war that ended 60 years ago. The body does not include Japan or Germany, the world's second and third largest economies, or India, the world's largest democracy, or any Latin American or African country. The Security Council exemplifies the antique structure of global governance more broadly. The G8 does not include China, already the world's fourth largest economy, or India and South Korea, the 12th and 13th. By tradition, the IMF is always headed by a European and the World Bank by an American. This tradition, like the customs of an old segregated country club, may be charming and amusing to insiders, but to outsiders, it is bigoted and outrageous. A further complication. When I write of the rise of nationalism, I am describing a broader phenomenon, the assertion of identity. The nation-state is a relatively new invention, often no more than 100 years old. Much older are the religious, ethnic, and linguistic groups that live within nation-states. And these bonds have stayed strong, in fact grown, as economic interdependence has deepened. In Europe, the Flemish and French in Belgium remain as distinct as ever. In Britain, the Scots have elected a ruling party that proposes ending the 300-year-old Acts of Union that created the United Kingdom of England, Scotland, and Wales. In India, national parties are losing ground to regional ones. In Kenya, tribal distinctions are becoming more important. In much of the world, these core identities, deeper than the nation-state, remain the defining features of life. It is why people vote and what they die for. In an open-world economy, these groups know that they need the central government less and less. And in a democratic age, they gain greater and greater power if they stay together as a group. This ascendancy of identity means, when relating to the United States or the United Nations or the world at large, Chinese and Indian nationalism grows. But within their own countries, subnationalism is also growing. What is happening on the global stage, the rise of identity in the midst of economic growth, is also happening on the local stage. The bottom line? It makes purposeful national action far more difficult. As power becomes diversified and diffuse, legitimacy becomes even more important, because it is the only way to appeal to all the disparate actors on the world stage. Today, no solution, no matter how sensible, is sustainable if it is seen as illegitimate. Imposing it will not work if it is seen as the product of one country's power and preferences, no matter how powerful that country. The massacres in Darfur, for example, are horrific, and yet military intervention there, the most effective way of stopping it, would succeed only if sanctioned by the major powers as well as Sudan's African neighbors. If the United States acted alone, or with a small coalition, invading its third Muslim country in 5 years, the attempt would almost certainly backfire, providing the Sudanese government with a fierce rallying cry against U.S. imperialism. The Bush administration's foreign policy record offers a perfect illustration of the practical necessity of legitimacy. And yet, beyond Bush's failures, the dilemma remains. if many countries need to cooperate to get things done, how to make this happen in a world with more players, many of them more powerful. The last superpower. Many observers and commentators have looked at the vitality of this emerging world and concluded that the United States has had its day. Andy Grove, the founder of Intel, puts it bluntly. America is in danger of following Europe down the tubes, he says. And the worst part is that nobody knows it. They're all in denial, patting themselves on the back, as the Titanic heads straight for the iceberg, full speed ahead. Thomas Friedman describes watching waves of young Indian professionals getting to work for the night shift at Infosys in Bangalore. Oh my God, there are so many of them, and they just keep coming wave after wave. How in the world can it possibly be good for my daughter and millions of other Americans that these Indians can do the same jobs as they can for a fraction of the wages? Globalization is striking back, writes Gabor Steinhardt, an editor at Germany's leading news magazine, Der Spiegel, in a best-selling book. As its rivals have prospered, he argues, the United States has lost key industries, its people have stopped saving money, and its government has become increasingly indebted to Asian central banks. What's puzzling, however, is that these trends have been around for a while, and they have actually helped America's bottom line. Over the past 20 years, as globalization and outsourcing have accelerated dramatically, America's growth rate has averaged just over 3%, a full percentage point higher than that of Germany and France. Japan averaged 2.3% over the same period. Productivity growth, the elixir of modern economics, has been over 2.5% for a decade now. Again, a full percentage point higher than the European average. Even American exports held up, despite a decade-long spike in the value of the dollar that has ended recently. In 1980, U.S. exports represented 10% of the world total. In 2007, that figure was still almost 9%. According to the World Economic Forum, the United States remains the most competitive economy in the world and ranks first in innovation, ninth in technological readiness, second in company spending for research and technology, and second in the quality of its research institutions. China does not come within 30 countries of the United States in any of these, and India breaks the top 10 on only one count, market size. In virtually every sector that advanced industrial countries participate, U.S. firms lead the world in productivity and profits. The United States' share of the global economy has been remarkably steady through wars, depressions, and a slew of other powers rising. With 5% of the world's population, the United States has generated between 20 and 30% of world output for 125 years. There will surely be some slippage of America's position over the next few decades. This is not a political statement, but a mathematical one. As other countries grow faster, America's relative economic weight will fall. But the decline need not be large-scale, rapid, or consequential, as long as the United States can adapt to new challenges as well as it adapted to those it confronted over the last century. In the next few decades, the rise of the emerging nations is likely to come mostly at the expense of Western Europe and Japan, which are locked in a slow, demographically determined decline. America will face the most intense economic competition it has ever faced. The American economic and social system knows how to respond and adjust to such pressures. The reforms needed are obvious, but because they mean some pain now, for long-term gain, the political system cannot make them. The more difficult challenge that the United States faces is international. It will confront a global order quite different from the one it is used to operating in. For now, the United States remains the most powerful player, but every year, the balance shifts. For the roughly two decades since 1989, the power of the United States has defined the international order. All roads have led to Washington, and American ideas about politics, economics, and foreign policy have been the starting points for global action. Washington has been the most powerful outside actor on every continent in the world, dominating the Western Hemisphere, remaining the crucial outside balancer in Europe and East Asia, expanding its role in the Middle East and Central and South Asia, and everywhere remaining the only country that can provide the muscle for any serious global military operation. For every country, from Russia and China to South Africa and India, its most important relationship in the world has been the relationship with the United States. That influence reached its apogee with Iraq. Despite the reluctance, opposition, or active hostility of much of the world, the United States was able to launch an unprovoked attack on a sovereign country and to enlist dozens of countries and international agencies to assist it during and after the invasion. It is not just the complications of Iraq that have unwound this order. Even if Iraq had been a glorious success, the method of its execution would have made utterly clear the unchallenged power of the United States. And it is this exercise of unipolarity that has provoked a reaction around the world. The unipolar order of the last two decades is waning not because of Iraq, but because of the broader diffusion of power across the world. On some matters, unipolarity seems already to have ended. The European Union now represents the largest trade bloc on the globe, creating bipolarity. And as China and then other emerging giants gain size, the bipolar realm of trade might become tripolar and then multipolar. In every realm except military, similar shifts are underway. In general, however, the notion of a multipolar world with four or five players of roughly equal weight does not describe reality today or in the near future. Europe cannot act militarily or even politically as one. Japan and Germany are hamstrung by their past. China and India are still developing. Instead, the international system is more accurately described by Samuel Huntington's term, uni-multipolarity, or what Chinese strategists call many powers and one superpower. The messy language reflects the messy reality. The United States remains by far the most powerful country, but in a world with several other important great powers, and with greater assertiveness and activity from all actors. This hybrid international system, more democratic, more dynamic, more open, more connected, is one we are likely to live with for several decades. It is easier to define what it is not than what it is, easier to describe the era it is moving away from than the era it is moving toward. Hence, the post-American world. The United States occupies the top spot in the emerging system, but it is also the country that is most challenged by the new order. Most other great powers will see their role in the world expand. That process is already underway. China and India are becoming bigger players in their neighborhoods and beyond. Russia has ended its post-Soviet accommodation and is becoming more forceful, even aggressive. Japan, though not a rising power, is now more willing to voice its views and positions to its neighbors. Europe acts on matters of trade and economics with immense strength and purpose. Brazil and Mexico are becoming more vocal on Latin American issues. South Africa has positioned itself as a leader on the African continent. All these countries are taking up more space in the international arena than they did before. For the United States, the arrow is pointing in the opposite direction. Economics is not a zero-sum game. The rise of other players expands the pie, which is good for all. But geopolitics is a struggle for influence and control. As other countries become more active, America's enormous space for action will inevitably diminish. Can the United States accommodate itself to the rise of other powers of various political stripes on several continents? This does not mean becoming resigned to chaos or aggression. Far from it. But the only way for the United States to deter rogue actions will be to create a broad, durable coalition against them. And that will be possible only if Washington can show that it is willing to allow other countries to become stakeholders in the new order. In today's international order, progress means compromise. No country will get its way entirely. These are easy words to write or say, but difficult to implement. They mean accepting the growth in power and influence of other countries. This balance between accommodation and deterrence is the chief challenge for American foreign policy in the next few decades. I began this chapter by arguing that the new order did not herald American decline, because I believe that America has enormous strengths and that the New World will not throw up a new superpower, but rather a diversity of forces that Washington can navigate and even help direct. But still, as the rest of the world rises, in purely economic terms, America will experience relative decline. As others grow faster, its share of the pie will be smaller, though the shift will likely be small for many years. In addition, the new non-governmental forces that are increasingly active will constrain Washington substantially. This is a challenge for Washington, but also for everyone else. For almost three centuries, the world has been undergirded by the presence of a large liberal hegemon, first Britain, then the United States. These two superpowers helped create and maintain an open world economy, protecting trade routes and sea lanes, acting as lenders of last resort, holding the reserve currency, investing abroad, and keeping their own markets open. They also tipped the military balance against the great aggressors of their ages, from Napoleon's France to Germany to the Soviet Union. For all its abuses of power, the United States has been the creator and sustainer of the current order of open trade and democratic government, an order that has been benign and beneficial for the vast majority of humankind. As things change, and as America's role changes, that order could begin to fracture. The collapse of the dollar, to the point where there was no global reserve currency, would be a problem for the world just as much as for America. And solving common problems in an era of diffusion and decentralization could turn out to be far more difficult without a superpower. Some Americans have become acutely conscious of the changing world. American business is increasingly aware of the shifts taking place around the world and is responding to them rapidly and unsentimentally. Large U.S.-based multinationals almost uniformly report that their growth now relies on penetrating new foreign markets. With annual revenue growth of 2-3% a year in the United States and 10-15% a year abroad, they know they have to adapt to a post-American world or else lose out in it. A similar awareness is visible in America's universities, where more and more students study and travel abroad and interact with foreign students. Younger Americans live comfortably with the knowledge that the latest trends in finance, architecture, art, technology might originate in London, Shanghai, Seoul, Tallinn, or Mumbai. But this outward orientation is not yet common in American society more broadly. The American economy remains internally focused, though this is changing, with trade making up 28% of GDP, compared with 38% for Germany. Insularity has been one of nature's blessings to America, bordered as it is by two vast oceans and two benign neighbors. America has not been sullied by the machinations and weariness of the old world, and has always been able to imagine a new and different order, whether in Germany, Japan, or even Iraq. But at the same time, this isolation has left Americans quite unaware of the world beyond their borders. Americans speak few languages, know little about foreign cultures, and remain unconvinced that they need to rectify this. Americans rarely benchmark to global standards because they are sure that their way must be the best and most advanced. The result is that they are increasingly suspicious of this emerging global era. There is a growing gap between America's worldly business elite and cosmopolitan class on the one hand, and the majority of the American people on the other. Without real efforts to bridge it, this divide could destroy America's competitive edge and its political future. Popular suspicions are fed and encouraged by an irresponsible national political culture. In Washington, new thinking about a new world is sorely lacking. It's easy enough to criticize the Bush administration for its arrogance and unilateralism, which have handicapped America abroad. But the problem is not confined to Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, or the Republicans, even though they have become the party of chest-thumping machismo, almost proud to be despised abroad. Listen to some Democrats in Washington, and you will hear a weaker unilateralism on trade, labor standards, and various pet human rights issues. On terrorism, both parties continue to speak in language entirely designed for a domestic audience with no concern for the poisonous effect it has everywhere else. American politicians constantly and promiscuously demand, label, sanction, and condemn whole countries for myriad failings. Over the last 15 years, the United States has placed sanctions on half the world's population. We are the only country in the world to issue annual report cards on every other country's behavior. Washington, D.C. has become a bubble, smug and out of touch with the world outside. The 2007 Pew Global Attitudes Survey showed a remarkable increase worldwide in positive views about free trade, markets, and democracy. Large majorities in countries from China and Germany to Bangladesh and Nigeria said that growing trade ties between countries were good. Of the 47 countries polled, however, the one that came in dead last in terms of support for free trade was the United States. In the 5 years the survey has been done, no country has seen as great a drop-off as the United States. Or take a look at the attitudes toward foreign companies. When asked whether they had a positive impact, a surprisingly large number of people in countries like Brazil, Nigeria, India, and Bangladesh said yes. Those countries have typically been suspicious of Western multinationals. South Asia's unease has some basis. After all, it was initially colonized by a multinational corporation, the British East India Company. And yet, 73% in India, 75% in Bangladesh, 70% in Brazil, and 82% in Nigeria now have positive views of these companies. The figure for America, in contrast, is 45%, which places us in the bottom five. We want the world to accept American companies with open arms, but when they come here, that's a different matter. Attitudes on immigration represent an even larger reversal. On an issue where the United States has been the model for the world, the country has regressed towards an angry, defensive crouch. Where we once wanted to pioneer every new technology, we now look at innovation fearfully, wondering how will it change things. The irony is that the rise of the rest is a consequence of American ideas and actions. For 60 years, American politicians and diplomats have traveled around the world, pushing countries to open their markets, free up their politics, and embrace trade and technology. We have urged peoples in distant lands to take up the challenge of competing in the global economy, freeing up their currencies, and developing new industries. We counsel them to be unafraid of change and learn the secrets of our success. And it worked. The natives have gotten good at capitalism. But now we are becoming suspicious of the very things we have long celebrated: free markets, trade, immigration, and technological change. And all this is happening when the tide is going our way. Just as the world is opening up, America is closing down. Generations from now, when historians write about these times, they might note that in the early decades of the 21st century, the United States succeeded in its great and historic mission. It globalized the world. But along the way, they might write, it forgot to globalize itself. Chapter 3: A Non-Western World. In 1492, as everyone knows, Christopher Columbus set sail on one of the most ambitious expeditions in human history. What is less well known is that 87 years earlier, a Chinese admiral named Zheng He began the first of seven equally ambitious expeditions. Zheng's ships were much bigger and better constructed than those of Columbus or Vasco da Gama or any of Europe's other great 15th and 16th century seafarers. On his first trip in 1405, he took 317 vessels and 28,000 men, compared with Columbus's four boats and 150 sailors. The largest vessels in the Chinese fleet, the treasure ships, were over 400 feet, more than four times the length of Columbus's flagship Santa Maria, and had nine masts. Each required so much wood that 300 acres of forest were felled to build a single one. There were ships designed to carry horses, supplies, food, water, and of course troops. The smallest vessel in Zheng's flotilla, a highly maneuverable five-masted warship, was still twice as large as the legendary Spanish galleon. The Chinese ships were constructed with special woods, intricate joints, sophisticated waterproofing techniques, and an adjustable centerboard keel. The treasure ships had large, luxurious cabins, silk sails, and windowed halls. All were constructed on dry docks in Nanjing, the world's largest and most advanced shipbuilding port. In the 3 years after 1405, 1,681 ships were built or refitted at Nanjing. Nothing remotely comparable could have happened in Europe at the time. Size mattered. These massive fleets were meant to shock and awe the inhabitants of the surrounding area, making clear the power and reach of the Ming Dynasty. On his 7 voyages, between 1405 and 1433, Zheng traveled widely through the waters of the Indian Ocean and around Southeast Asia. He gave gifts to the natives and accepted tributes. When encountering opposition, he did not hesitate to use military might. On 1 voyage, he brought back a captured Sumatran pirate, on another, a rebellious chief from Ceylon. He returned from all of them with flowers, fruits, precious stones, and exotic animals, including giraffes and zebras for the imperial zoo. But Zheng's story ends oddly. By the 1430s, a new emperor had come to power. He abruptly ended the imperial expeditions and turned his back on trade and exploration. Some officials tried to keep the tradition going, but to no avail. In 1500, the court decreed that anyone who built a ship with more than 2 masts, the size required to go any distance at sea, would be executed. In 1525, coastal authorities were ordered to destroy any ocean-going vessels they encountered and throw the owners in prison. In 1551, it became a crime to go to sea on a multi-mast ship for any purpose. When the Qing dynasty came to power in 1644, it continued this basic policy, but it had less faith in decrees. Instead, it simply scorched a 700-mile-long strip of China's southern coast, rendering it uninhabitable. These measures had the desired effect. China's shipping industry collapsed. In the decades after Zheng's last voyage, dozens of Western explorers traveled to the waters around India and China. But it took 300 years for a Chinese vessel to make its way to Europe on a visit to London for the Great Exhibition of 1851. What explains this remarkable turnaround? The Chinese elite were divided over the country's outward approach, and Beijing's new rulers considered the naval expeditions failures. They were extremely expensive, forced higher taxes on an already strained population, and provided very little return. Trade had flourished as a result of some of these contacts, but most of it had benefited only traders and pirates. In addition, by the mid-15th century, Mongols and other raiders were threatening the empire's frontiers, demanding attention and consuming resources. Seafaring seemed like a costly distraction. It was a fateful decision. Just as China chose to turn away from the outside world, Europe was venturing abroad. And it was Europe's naval expeditions that allowed it to energize itself and spread its power and influence across the globe. If China had kept its navy afloat, would the course of modern history have been different? Probably not. China's decision to turn inward was not simply one bad strategic call. It was an expression of a civilization's stagnation. Behind the decision to end the expeditions lay the whole complex of reasons why China and most of the non-Western world lagged behind the Western world for so many centuries. And lag they did. For hundreds of years after the 15th century, while Europe and the United States industrialized, urbanized, and modernized, the rest of the world remained poor and agricultural. If we are to understand what the rise of the rest means, we must understand just how long the rest has been dormant. It turns out that the intellectual and material dominance of the West is neither a recent nor an ephemeral phenomenon. We have lived in a Western world for over 500,000 years. Despite the rise of other nations and continents, the shadows of the West will be long and its legacies deep for decades to come, perhaps longer. It has become commonplace to say that actually China and India were as rich as the West right up until the 1800s. The dominance of the West, according to this perspective, has been a 200-year blip, and we are now returning to a more normal balance. This statement also implies that the West's advantages may be largely accidental, the result, in one scholar's words, of coal and colonies, that is, the discovery of a cheap energy source and the domination of the rich lands of Asia, Africa, and the Americas. This view, which embraces a multicultural sensibility that denies any special status to the West, has its political advantages. But while it may be politically correct, it is historically incorrect. One reason for this misinterpretation is that analysts often focus solely on the total size of the Chinese and Indian economies. Historically, this has been a misleading statistic. Until the modern age, a country's economy could not be mobilized, extracted, or put to use in any meaningful sense. The fact that in, say, the 17th century, millions of peasants in remote and unconnected corners of China were working the land in grinding poverty did not really contribute to the nation's usable wealth or power, even though their output added up to a large number. Population was the main ingredient of GDP, and production was largely agricultural. Since China and India had four times the population of Western Europe in 1600, their GDP was, of course, larger. Even in 1913, when Britain was the world's leading power, with cutting-edge technology and industrial production and trade many times larger than all of Asia's, China could claim a greater total GDP. In studying the pre-industrial age, before big government, communications, transport, and broad-based taxation, aggregate GDP alone tells us little about national power or a country's level of advancement. It doesn't say anything about the dynamism of a society or its ability to make new discoveries and inventions. And it was mastery in these areas that gave a country new ways to create wealth and its government power. We get a much clearer picture of the real standing of countries if we consider economic growth and GDP per capita. Western European GDP per capita was higher than both China and India by 1500. By 1600, it was 50% higher than China's. From there, the gap kept growing. Between 1350 and 1950, for 600 years, GDP per capita remained roughly constant in China and India, hovering around $600 for China and $550 for India. In the same period, Western European GDP per capita went from $662 to $4,594, a 594% increase. European travelers in the 17th century routinely pointed out that Chinese and Indian living conditions were well below those in northwestern Europe. The economist Gregory Clark calculates that in the 18th century, the average daily wage of a laborer in Amsterdam could buy him 21 pounds of wheat, in London 16 pounds, and in Paris 10. In China, a day's wages would buy about 6.6 pounds of wheat or its equivalent. Clark has also examined records to determine differences in the number of famines, which points in the same direction. The West, in short, was more prosperous than the East long before the 18th century. Still, it was not always thus. For the first centuries of the second millennium, the East was ahead of the West by almost every measure. As Europe foundered in the depths of the Middle Ages, both the Middle East and Asia prospered, with lively traditions of scholarship, invention, and trade. The Middle East was at the forefront of civilization, preserving and building on Greek and Roman knowledge and producing path-breaking work in fields as diverse as mathematics, physics, medicine, anthropology, and psychology. Arabic numerals, of course, were invented there, as was the concept of zero. The word algebra comes from the title of a book, Al-Jabr wal Al-Muqbila, by an Arab scholar. The word algorithm derives from the scholar's name, Al-Khwarizmi. Militarily, the Ottomans were the envy of their rivals and continued to expand their empire, battling Western states in Central Asia and Europe until the 17th century. India, during its most vibrant eras, boasted scientific prowess, artistic genius, and architectural splendor. Even in the early 16th century, under Krishnadeva Raya, the southern Indian city of Vijayanagar was described by many foreign visitors as one of the great cities of the world, comparable to Rome. A few centuries earlier, China was probably richer and more technologically sophisticated than any other country, using various technologies, gunpowder, movable type, the stirrup, that the West would stumble upon only centuries later. Even Africa had a higher average income than Europe during this period. The tide began to turn in the 15th century, and by the 16th century, Europe had moved ahead. With the revolution in thought that is termed the Renaissance, men like Copernicus, Vesalius, and Galileo gave birth to modern science. Indeed, the 100 years between 1450 and 1550 marked the most significant break in human history, between faith, ritual, and dogma on the one hand, and observation, experimentation, and critical thought on the other. And it happened in Europe, pushing that civilization forward for centuries. By 1593, when an English ship equipped with 87 guns traveled 3,700 miles to arrive in Istanbul, an Ottoman historian would call it a wonder of the age, the like of which has not been seen or recorded. By the 17th century, almost every kind of technology, product, and complex organization, like a corporation or an army, was more advanced in Western Europe than anywhere else in the world. To believe that Asian societies were in any material sense on par with the West in 1700 or 1800 is to believe that the scientific and technological advances that revolutionized the Western world over the preceding 300 years had no effect on its material condition, which is absurd. Scientific advances were not merely about creating new machines. They reshaped the mental outlook of Western societies. Take the mechanical clock, which was invented in Europe in the 13th century. The historian Daniel Burstein calls it the mother of machines. The clock, he notes, broke down the walls between kinds of knowledge, ingenuity, and skill, and clockmakers were the first consciously to apply the theories of mechanics and physics to the making of machines. Its broader effects were even more revolutionary. The clock freed man from dependence on the sun and moon. It made it possible to order the day, define the night, organize work, and perhaps most important, measure the cost of labor by tracking the number of hours that went into a project. Before the clock, time had no measurable value. By the 16th century, when the Portuguese brought them to China, Europe's mechanical clocks were much more sophisticated than the clumsy water clocks made in Beijing. The Chinese, however, saw little value in these machines, viewing them as toys, and they never bothered to learn how to run them. Having acquired some, they needed Europeans to stay behind to work their inventions. Similarly, when the Portuguese brought cannons to Beijing 100 years later, they had to supply operators for the machines. China could consume modern technology, but it could not produce it. And by the 18th century, Beijing no longer even wanted to see foreign gadgets. In a famous letter to George III, the Qianlong Emperor, who ruled from 1736 to 1795, rejected Britain's request for trade, explaining, "We have never set much store on strange and ingenious objects, nor do we need any more of your country's manufacturers." The Chinese had closed their minds to the world. Without new technologies and techniques, Asia fell prey to the classic Malthusian problem. Thomas Malthus's famous 1798 treatise, An Essay on the Principle of Population, is remembered today for its erroneous pessimism. But in fact, many of Malthus's insights were highly intelligent. He observed that food production in England rose at an arithmetic rate, 1, 2, 3, 4, but population grew at a geometric rate, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16. This mismatch, unless altered, would ensure that the country would be hungry and impoverished, and that only catastrophes like famine and disease could raise living standards by shrinking the population. Malthus's dilemma was quite real, but he failed to appreciate the power of technology. He did not realize that these very pressures would generate a human response in Europe, the agricultural revolution, which vastly expanded the production of food. The continent also eased population pressures by exporting tens of millions of people to various colonies, mostly in the Americas. So Malthus was wrong about Europe. His analysis, however, well described Asia and Africa. Strength is weakness. And yet, how to make sense of those extraordinary Chinese voyages? Zheng He's dazzling fleet is just one part of a larger picture of remarkable achievements in China and India. Palaces, courts, cities, at the very time that the West was moving ahead of them. The Taj Mahal was built in 1631 to honor the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan's beloved wife, Mumtaz Mahal. A British traveler, William Hodges, was one of many to point out that there was nothing like it in Europe. The fine materials, the beautiful forms, and the symmetry of the whole, he wrote, far surpass anything I ever beheld. Building the Taj took enormous talent and skill, as well as astonishing feats of engineering. How could a society produce such wonders of the world and yet not move ahead more broadly? If China could put together such spectacular and sophisticated naval expeditions, why could it not make clocks? Part of the answer lies in the way the Mughals built the Taj Mahal. 20,000 laborers worked night and day on the site for 20 years. They built a ramp 10 miles long just to move materials up to the 187-foot-high dome. The budget was unlimited, and no value was placed on the man-hours put into the project. If you had to ask, you couldn't afford the Taj Mahal. Zheng He's flotilla was produced by a similar command system, as was Beijing's Forbidden City. Begun in 1406, the city required the labor of 1 million men and another 1 million soldiers to watch over them. If all of a large society's energies and resources are directed at a few projects, those projects often become successes, but isolated successes. The Soviet Union boasted an extraordinary space program well into the 1970s, even though by then it was technologically the most backward of all the industrial nations. But throwing more manpower at a problem is not the path to innovation. The historian Philip Huang makes a fascinating comparison between the farmers of the Yangtze Delta and those of England, the richest regions of China and Europe respectively, in 1800. He points out that by some measures, the two areas might seem to have been at equivalent economic levels. But in fact, Britain was far ahead in the key measure of growth, labor productivity. The Chinese were able to make their land highly productive, but they did so by putting more and more people to work on a given acre, what Huang calls output without development. The English, on the other hand, kept searching for ways to make labor more productive so that each farmer was producing more crops. They discovered new labor-saving devices, using animals and inventing machines. When the multi-spindle wheel, which required one trained operator, was developed, for example, it was widely adapted in England. But in China, the inferior but cheaper single spindle persisted because it could be used by many untrained operators. Since labor had little value, why spend money on labor-saving machines? Ultimately, the result was that a small number of Britons were able to farm huge swaths of land. By the 18th century, the average farm size in southern England was 150 acres. In the Yangtze Delta, it was about 1 acre. The naval expeditions also illustrate the difference in the eastern and western approaches. The European missions were less grand but more productive. They were often entirely private or public-private partnerships and used new methods to pay for the trips. The Dutch pioneered innovations in finance and taxation. Their herring traders were using future contracts widely by the 1580s. And these financial mechanisms marked a crucial advance because they ensured funding for an ever-increasing number of expeditions. Each trip was intended to turn a profit, make new discoveries, and find new products. The project moved forward by trial and error, with every expedition building on past ones. Over time, a chain reaction of entrepreneurship, exploration, science, and learning developed. In China, by contrast, the voyages depended on the interests and power of one monarch. When he was gone, they stopped. In one case, a new emperor even ordered the destruction of ship schematics so that the capacity to build them was lost. The Chinese used cannons effectively in the 13th century. 300 years later, they couldn't operate one without a European to show them how. The Harvard economic historian David Landis concludes that China failed to generate a continuous, self-sustaining process of scientific and technological advance. Its achievements ended up being episodic and ephemeral. This was the tragedy of Asia. Even when there was knowledge, there was no learning. Is culture destiny? Why did non-Western countries stand still while the West moved forward? These questions have been debated for centuries, and there is no neat answer. Private property rights, good institutions of governance, and a strong civil society, that is, one not dominated by the state, were clearly crucial for growth in Europe and later the United States. In contrast, the Russian Tsar theoretically owned his entire country. In China, the Ming court was run by mandarins who disdained commerce. Almost everywhere in the non-Western world, civil society was weak and dependent on the government. Local businessmen in India were always captive to the whims of the court. In China, rich merchants would abandon their businesses to master Confucian classics so that they could become favorites of the court. The Mughals and the Ottomans were warriors and aristocrats who thought of trade as unglamorous and unimportant, even though the Middle East had a long merchant tradition. In India, this bias was reinforced by the low position of businessmen in the Hindu caste hierarchy. Historians have taken particular note of Hindu beliefs and practices as barriers to development. Paul Kennedy argues, the sheer rigidity of Hindu religious taboos militated against modernization. Rodents and insects could not be killed, so vast amounts of foodstuff were lost. Social mores about handling refuse and excreta led to permanently insanitary conditions, a breeding ground for bubonic plagues. The caste system throttled initiative, instilled ritual, and restricted the market. And the influence wielded over Indian local rulers by the Brahmin priests meant that this obscurantism was effective at the highest level. J.M. Roberts makes a broader point about the Hindu worldview, observing that it was a vision of endless cycles of creation and reabsorption into the divine, which led to passivity and skepticism about the value of practical action. But if culture is everything, how to account for China and India now? Today, their remarkable growth is often explained with pains to their distinctive cultures. Confucianism was once bad for growth. Now it is good. The Hindu mindset, once an impediment, is now seen to embody a kind of practical worldliness that undergirds entrepreneurial capitalism. The success of the Chinese and Hindu diaspora seemingly provides daily confirmation of such theories. The late Daniel Patrick Moynihan, America's leading scholar senator, once said, "The central conservative truth is that it is culture, not politics, that determines the success of a society. The central liberal truth is that politics can change a culture and save it from itself." That gets it just about right. Culture is important, terribly important, but it can change. Cultures are complex. At any given moment, certain attributes are prominent and seem immutable. And then politics and economics shift, and those attributes wane in importance, making space for others. The Arab world was once the center of science and trade. In recent decades, its chief exports have been oil and Islamic fundamentalism. Any cultural argument must be able to explain both periods of success and periods of failure. Why was Asian commercialism, so prominent now, buried for centuries? A large part of the explanation must lie in the structure of their states. Most countries in Asia had powerful and centralized predatory states that extracted taxes from their subjects without providing much in return. From the 15th century through the 19th, Asian rulers largely fit the stereotype of the Oriental tyrant. After the Mughals swept into India from the north in the 15th century, their rapacious rule consisted of demanding taxes and tributes and building palaces and forts while neglecting infrastructure, communications, trade, and discovery. The reign of Akbar from 1556 to 1605 was a brief exception. Hindu princes in southern India were not much better. Businessmen had to keep interest rates high in anticipation of frequent and arbitrary taxation by their rulers. No one had much of an incentive to build wealth, since it was likely to be confiscated. In the Middle East, centralization came much later. When the region was ruled in a relatively lax and decentralized manner under the Ottoman Empire, trade, commerce, and innovation flourished. Goods, ideas, and people from everywhere mingled freely. But in the 20th century, an effort to create modern and powerful nation-states resulted in dictatorships that brought economic and political stagnation. Civic organizations were marginalized. With strong states and weak societies, the Arab world fell behind the rest of the world by almost every measure of progress. Why was this type of centralized state being limited and constrained in Europe, even as it flourished in much of the non-Western world? Partly because of the Christian Church, which was the first major institution that could contest the power of kings. Partly because of Europe's landed elite, which had an independent base in the countryside and acted as a check on royal absolutism. The Magna Carta, the first great Bill of Rights of the Western world, was actually a charter of baronial privileges forced on the king by his nobles, partly, and some would say ultimately, because of geography. Europe is broken up by wide rivers, tall mountains, and large valleys. This topography produced many natural borders and encouraged political communities of varying sizes: city-states, duchies, republics, nations, and empires. In 1500, Europe had more than 500 states, city-states, and principalities. This diversity meant there was constant competition of ideas, people, art, money, and weapons. People who were mistreated or shunned in one place could escape to another and thrive. States that succeeded were copied. Those that failed died. Over time, this competition helped Europe become highly skilled at both making wealth and making war. Asia, by contrast, consists of vast flatlands, the steppes in Russia, the plains in China. Armies can move through these areas quickly and with little opposition. The Chinese had to build the Great Wall because they could not rely on any natural barrier to protect their territory. This geography helped sustain large, centralized land empires that were able to maintain their grip on power for centuries. Consider, for instance, the episode with which we began this chapter, the Ming Dynasty's decision to end sea exploration after Zheng He's voyages. Perhaps the most notable fact about the ban on sea expeditions was that it worked. Such a policy could not have been implemented in Europe. No king was powerful enough to enforce such a decree. And even if one had been, the people and their expertise would simply have moved to a neighboring nation, city-state, or principality. In China, the emperor could turn back time. Europe's waterways were also a blessing. Its rivers flowed gently into sheltered, navigable bays. The Rhine is a wide, slow-moving river that can be used as a highway for goods and people. The Mediterranean is calm, almost a lake, with many big ports. Compare this to Africa. Despite being the second largest continent, Africa has the shortest coastline, much of which is too shallow to build major ports. Most of its big rivers, fast-moving, dramatic, vertiginous, are not navigable. Add to that tropical heat and propensity for disease and food spoilage, and you have a compelling geographic explanation for African underdevelopment. Surely not the only factor, but a significant one. These grand explanations make it seem as if things could not have turned out any other way. But in fact, such structural factors tell you only of a society's predispositions, what the odds favor. Sometimes the odds can be beaten, Despite its geographic diversity, Europe was once conquered by a great land empire, Rome, which tried, with diminishing success, to keep the empire centralized. The Middle East did well at one point under a vast empire. China prospered for centuries despite its flat geography, and India also had its periods of effervescence. European advantages, so clear in retrospect, were initially small and related mostly to the weapons and techniques of war. Over time, however, the advantages multiplied and reinforced each other, and the West moved further and further ahead of the rest. The spoils of victory. Contact with the rest of the world stimulated Europe. The discovery of new seaways, rich civilizations, and strange peoples stirred the energy and imagination of the West. Everywhere Europeans went, they found goods, markets, and opportunities. By the 17th century, Western nations were increasing their influence over every region and culture with which they came into contact. No part of the world would remain untouched, from the lands across the Atlantic to the far reaches of Africa and Asia. By the end of the 18th century, even Australia and the small islands of the South Pacific had been marked for use by Europeans. The Far East, China and Japan, at first remained insulated from this influence, but by the mid-19th century, they too fell prey to Western advances. The rise of the West led to the beginnings of a global civilization, one that was defined, shaped, and dominated by the nations of Western Europe. Initially, Europeans were focused on finding products that people might want back home. This sometimes took the form of plunder, at other times trade. They brought back furs from the Americas, spices from Asia, and gold and diamonds from Brazil. Soon, however, their involvement became more permanent. Their interest varied depending on the climate. In temperate regions, starting with North and South America, Europeans settled, recreating Western-style societies in far-off places. That was the beginning of what they called the New World. In lands they found uninhabitable, often tropical climes like Southeast Asia and Africa, they created a system of agriculture to produce crops that would be of interest in domestic markets. The Dutch set up vast farms in the East Indies, as did the Portuguese in Brazil. These were soon eclipsed by the French and English plantations in the Caribbean, which used Africans as slaves for labor. Within 100 years of initial European contact, one trend was unmistakable and irreversible. These encounters changed or destroyed the existing political, social, and economic arrangements in non-Western societies. The old order collapsed, or was destroyed, or often a combination of the two. This was true no matter the country's size. From tiny Burma, where the traditional social structure crumbled under British rule, to the large tribes of Africa, where European nations drew new borders, created new divisions, and put favored groups into power. In many cases, this external influence introduced modernity, even if sometimes accompanied by great brutality. In other cases, European influence was regressive, destroying old ways but creating little to replace them. In any event, America, Asia, and Africa were forever and irreversibly altered by their discovery by the West. The direction of European expansion was determined by the balance of power. For several centuries, despite their mastery of the oceans, European nations did not have any military advantage over Turks and Arabs. So they traded with, but did not try to dominate, the lands of the Middle East and North Africa until the early 19th century. In Asia, the Europeans saw few easy pathways into the continent and instead set up trading posts and offices and contented themselves with the scraps ignored by the Chinese. In sub-Saharan Africa and the Americas, by contrast, they were clearly stronger than the natives and knew it. Portuguese expansion started in Africa, with moves into the Congo and the Zambezi in the early 16th century, but the climate there was inhospitable for settlement, so they turned to the Western Hemisphere. America was a mistake. Columbus was searching for a path to the Indies and bumped up against a large obstacle. But it turned out to be a happy accident. the Americas became Europe's great escape valve for 400 years. Europeans left for the New World for a variety of reasons: overcrowding, poverty, religious persecution at home, or simply the desire for adventure. And when they landed, they found civilizations that were sophisticated in some ways, but militarily primitive. Tiny bands of European adventurers, Cortes, Pizarro, could defeat much larger native armies. This, coupled with European diseases that the natives could not withstand, led to the wholesale destruction of tribes and cultures. Colonization was often done not by countries, but by corporations. The Dutch and British East India Companies were licensed monopolies, created to end competition among the businessmen of each country. The French equivalent, the Compagnie des Indes, was an independently run state corporation. Initially, these commercial enterprises were uninterested in territory and concerned only with profits, but once invested in new areas, they wanted more stability and control. The European powers, meanwhile, wanted to keep rival countries out. Thus began the land grabs and construction of formal empires, of which Britain's grew to become the largest. With formal empire came grand ambitions. Westerners began looking beyond money alone to power, influence, and culture. They became, depending on your view, ideological or idealistic. European institutions, practices, and ideas were introduced and imposed, though always maintaining racial preferences. The British court system was brought to India, for example, but Indian magistrates could not try whites. Over time, the European impact on its colonies was huge, and then it spread well beyond the colonies. Neil Ferguson has argued that the British Empire is responsible for the worldwide spread of the English language, banking, the common law, Protestantism, team sports, the limited state, representative government, and the idea of liberty. Such an argument might gloss over the hypocrisy and brutality of imperial control: economic looting, mass executions, imprisonment, torture. Some, the Dutch and French, for example, might quibble with the exclusively English provenance of such ideas. But in any case, it is undeniable that as a consequence of empire, European ideas and practices blanketed the globe. Even in the Far East, where the West never made formal annexations, European impact was massive. When the weak and dysfunctional Qing court tried to ban the opium trade in the early 19th century, Britain, whose treasury had become addicted to revenues from opium, launched a naval attack. The Anglo-Chinese Wars, often called the Opium Wars, highlighted the power gap between the two countries. At their conclusion in 1842, Beijing was forced to agree to a series of concessions over and above the resumption of the opium trade. It ceded Hong Kong, opened 5 ports for British residents, granted all Britons exemption from Chinese laws, and paid a large indemnity. In 1853, Western ships, this time American, entered Japanese waters and put an end to Japan's policy of seclusion from the world. Japan subsequently signed a series of trade treaties that gave Western countries and their citizens special privileges. Formal empire continued to grow as well, extending into the lands of the sickly Ottoman Empire as well as Africa. This process of domination culminated in the early 20th century, at which point a handful of Western capitals ruled 85% of the world's land. Westernization. In 1823, the East India Company decided to set up a school in Calcutta to train locals. It seemed wise and straightforward enough, but the policy sparked a fiery letter to Britain's Prime Minister, William Pitt, from a leading Indian citizen of Calcutta, Raja Ram Mohan Roy. The letter is worth quoting at length. "When this seminary of learning was proposed, we were filled with sanguine hopes that this sum would be laid out in employing European gentlemen of talents and education to instruct the natives of India in mathematics, natural philosophy, chemistry, anatomy, and other useful sciences, which the nations of Europe have carried to a degree of perfection that has raised them above the inhabitants of other parts of the world," Roy wrote. He continued, we now find that the government are establishing a Sanskrit school under Hindu pundits to impart such knowledge as is already current in India. This seminary can only be expected to load the minds of the youth with grammatical niceties and metaphysical distinctions of little or no value to the possessors or to society. The Sanskrit language, so difficult that almost a lifetime is necessary for its perfect acquisition, is well known to have been for ages a lamentable check on the diffusion of knowledge. Neither can much improvement arise from such speculations as the following. Which are the themes suggested by the Vedant? In what manner is the soul absorbed into the deity? What relation does it bear to the divine essence? I beg leave to state, with due deference to your lordship's exalted status, that if the plan now adopted be followed, it will completely defeat the object proposed. Whenever you hear the argument that westernization was purely a matter of arms and force, think of this letter and hundreds of letters, memos, and orders like it. There was coercion behind the spread of Western ideas, but there were also many non-Westerners, like Raja Ram Mohan Roy, eager to learn the ways of the West. The reason for this was simple. They wanted to succeed, and people always tend to copy those who have succeeded. The West's prowess at amassing wealth and waging war was obvious to its neighbors by the 17th century. One of them, Peter the Great of Russia, spent months traveling through Europe, dazzled by its industries and its militaries. Determined to learn from them, he returned home and decreed a series of radical reforms, reorganizing the army along European lines, modernizing the bureaucracy, moving the capital from Asiatic Moscow to a new European-style city on the western edge of the Russian Empire, which he named St. Petersburg. He reformed the tax code and even tinkered with the structure of the Orthodox Church to make it more Western. Men were ordered to shave their beards and wear European-style clothing. If a man persisted in the old ways, he had to pay a beard tax of 100 rubles a year. Since Peter the Great, there has been a long, distinguished list of non-Westerners who have sought to bring the ideas of the West to their country. Some have been as radical as Peter. Perhaps the most famous of them was Kemal Atatürk, who took over the collapsing Ottoman state in 1922 and declared that Turkey had to abandon its past and embrace European culture to catch up with the West. He created a secular republic, Romanized the Turkish script, abolished the veil and the fez, and dismantled all the religious underpinnings of the Ottoman Caliphate. Earlier, in Japan in 1885, the great theorist of the Meiji Reformation, Yukichi Fukuzawa, wrote a famous essay, Leaving Asia, in which he argued that Japan needed to turn its back on Asia, particularly China and Korea, and cast its lot with the civilized countries of the West. Many Chinese reformers made similar arguments. Sun Yat-sen bluntly acknowledged Europe's superior status and the need to copy it to get ahead. Jawaharlal Nehru, independent India's first prime minister, believed that ending his country's backwardness required borrowing politically and economically from the West. Having been educated at Harrow and Cambridge, he had the outlook of a Western liberal. He once privately described himself as the last Englishman to rule India. Nehru's contemporaries around the world were similarly steeped in Western thought. Post-colonial leaders tried to free themselves from the West politically, but still wanted the Western path to modernity. Even the fiercely anti-Western Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt wore tailored suits and read voraciously in European history. His sources for policy ideas were invariably British, French, and American scholars and writers. His favorite movie was Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. We sometimes recall these leaders' fiery anti-Western rhetoric and Marxist orientation and think of them as having rejected the West. In fact, they were simply borrowing from the radical traditions of the West. Marx, Engels, Rosa Luxemburg, and Lenin were all Western intellectuals. Even today, when people in Asia or Africa criticize the West, they are often using arguments that were developed in London, Paris, or New York. Osama bin Laden's critique of America in a September 2007 videotape, which included references to Noam Chomsky, inequality, the mortgage crisis, and global warming could have been penned by a left-wing academic at Berkeley. In Joseph Conrad's novel Youth, the narrator recalls his first encounter with the East. "And then, before I could open my lips, the East spoke to me. But it was in a Western voice. The voice swore and cursed violently. It riddled the solemn peace of the bay by a volley of abuse. It began by calling me pig, and from that went crescendo into unmentionable adjectives in English." Non-Western leaders who admired the West have been most impressed by its superiority at producing wealth and winning wars. After its defeat at the hands of European forces in Vienna in 1683, the Ottoman Empire decided it had to learn from the ways of its adversaries. It bought weapons from Europe, and after realizing that it needed much more than machines, started importing organizational skill, techniques, and modes of thought and behavior. By the 19th century, Middle Eastern commanders were organizing their troops into Western-style armies, with the same platoons and battalions, the same colonels and generals. Militaries around the world converged to a single Western model. Today, whether in China, Indonesia, or Nigeria, a country's armed forces are largely standardized around a 19th-century Western template. Men like Roy, Fukuzawa, and Nehru were not making an argument about intrinsic cultural superiority. They were not Uncle Toms. In Roy's letter, he repeatedly compared Indian science in his day to European science before Francis Bacon. It was history, not genetics, that mattered. Sun Yat-sen was intimately familiar with the glories of China's past and with the richness of its tradition of learning. Fukuzawa was a scholar of Japanese history. Nehru spent his years in British jails writing passionate nationalist histories of India. They all believed in the glory of their own cultures, but they also believed that at that moment in history, in order to succeed economically, politically, and militarily, they had to borrow from the West.